Hi, everybody. I'm here today with Professor Kelvin Luke. Hi, Professor Luke. Could you please introduce yourself to the listeners?
As Ben mentioned, I'm Kelvin Luke, native of Toronto, Canada. I did my undergrad training in microbiology and immunology at McGill University. And I also obtained my PhD from that same institution and trained at the Montreal Neurological Institute there. So in my graduate work, I worked primarily in the development of the brain, development of the basal ganglia and also the midbrain. And that's how I initially got interested in the circuits that are involved with Parkinson's disease. And that interest in PD got me, led me eventually to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where I started a postdoctoral fellowship with Dr. Virginia Lee here at Penn. And I've been here ever since and joined the faculty in 2013 here. So I'm currently a research assistant professor in the Department of Pathology and also a member of the Center for Neurodegenerative Disease Research. So most of my work focuses now on understanding how Lewy bodies and other Lewy forms of Lewy pathology form in Parkinson's disease and related neurodegenerative diseases. And one of the very interesting processes that we've been focusing on the last several years is the idea that Lewy body pathology, or alpha-synuclein aggregates, as the more technical term to address them might be, their ability to spread between different areas of the brain. And we've been working very hard on trying to understand the mechanisms of how this occurs, how proteins can go from one place to another, and how they amplify, and ultimately how they become toxic for the neurons and cause neurodegeneration.
Wow. So I could sit here all day and ask you questions on all of those things, but I'll try not to do that. The first question I did have is, when you think of the disease that we call Parkinson's disease, do you primarily think of it as a protein folding problem?
Yes and no. So when I think of Parkinson's disease, the first thing that comes to mind are the patients and the symptoms and some of the challenges that they face. And in fact, what got me interested in PD research is actually, we have a lot of friends and family that I know who are affected by this as well. So that's the first thing that comes to mind when I think about PD. But I think you're right, at the heart of the disease in terms of mechanism, the basic biology that underpins what's happening in many of these patients is that there is a protein folding defect. And I think that that's a very intense area of research for us.
Okay. Now, do you believe that those factors that lead to that kind of initial misfolding of the proteins, are they the same factors that are responsible for the further formation of the clumps to form into oligomers and fibrils as well?
So I think that's something that's still a little bit of a black box to researchers in the field, the source, how proteins initially misfold. And when I talk about misfolded proteins, it's a very general term I use for alpha-synuclein in this case, mainly, that is in either a fibrillar form or an oligomer form, or even in a sort of soluble monomeric form that's just not in its correct shape. Unfortunately, I say black box because we still know very little about the correct shape in which alpha-synuclein should be in for it to function properly. I think there's a lot of very interesting work that's coming out of several groups. For example, the groups at Harvard, Dennis Selko, Tim Bartels, and others, also Tom Sudoff's group. I'm trying to understand the basic function of alpha-synuclein. But I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. So for now, I think misfolding is a very broad net, if you will.
Okay. Now, when you look at those, when you look upstream a little bit at the factors that lead to the initial misfolding, what is it that you see? And do you believe it is feasible to try and tackle this problem further upstream, or do we need to tackle it at the misfolding itself?
Do you mean by how we should tackle treating the disease?
Yes. I mean, ultimately, when people try and come up with different kinds of treatments for it, do you think tackling it at the level of the misfolding is the right way to go, or should we go farther upstream to the factors that might lead to that misfolding?
I think ideally we would want to tackle both. I think sometimes we take a very linear view of therapy and think that there might be a single silver bullet that can address a lot of these problems. I think, you know, especially looking to, for example, the cancer field, it's usually combination therapies are more effective than monotherapies. And you know, in terms of Parkinson's or protein misfolding, where that might come in is if there's something that can directly attack or target misfolded species in patients, I think that's very important because the initial event that led to misfolding, for example, might have taken place a long time ago, months, even years ago. And to chase after that after it has taken place may not be particularly fruitful. Mm-hmm. Having said that, you know, once we identify what that upstream cause is, if we know it's a chronic cause of misfolding, it doesn't hurt to inhibit it. In fact, it might be very beneficial. And one of the more creative approaches actually is now there are several groups that are trying to reduce alpha-synuclein expression overall, for example. Hmm. There's several biotechs, including Ionis and Biogen, are interested in knocking down synuclein expression with antisense oligonucleotides. And so by reducing the protein that's being misfolded, in a way you're trying to tackle the problem from both sides of the equation. Put it that way.
Okay. Now, the next question that I had, and I'm not sure how relevant this actually is to Parkinson's disease, but I was just wondering, just generally, it seems that when most people talk about protein misfolding problems, they talk about proteins that kind of fold too much and kind of collapse in on themselves and form these weird shapes that nobody can make sense of. But I wonder how much of it is the opposite problem, and that we just create these proteins that are too stiff and don't fold enough.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of ways to think about protein misfolding and why it might be bad. So one way, instead of thinking about physical properties, for example, how stiff or what shape it is exactly, we can think of it in terms of how it relates to function. So for example, we can think of proteins, because proteins are very complicated structures, mm-hmm. It needs to be folded correctly or almost entirely correctly in order to do its function. And if it's not folded in that shape, so any shape other than a functional shape leads to loss of function of that protein. So that's one way to think of it. Another way to think of it is that proteins might fold in other ways that are still functional but gain additional properties that are toxic. What we've learned from a lot of biophysical studies now, whether it's in the context of proteins that are related to neurodegeneration or in other, other proteins, is that it's not so much the flexibility or the shape, but it's usually a loss of function or a gain of function that is the most important factor.
Hmm. Okay. Now, do you think the aggregates that lead to neurodegeneration do so by resulting in the death of the cell or merely the loss of function? And if it is the latter, do you think that simply by clearing these protein buildups will the cells be able to function again? So in the case of Parkinson's, that means the cells will be able to produce dopamine again, or is that already too late in most cases?
Mm. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think that is one of the questions of the day, if you will. In the sense that we really don't know at this point. We definitely know that the aggregates, or at least Lewy bodies in general, almost in most cases, are associated with something detrimental to the cells. And if you look at the data that's come out of all of the experimental models, whether it's by overexpressing alpha-synuclein or trying to generate Lewy body-like pathology, as we've done in some of our own studies, these aggregates almost all the time tend to be bad for the cell. I would definitely put them in the negative category. That said, You know, there's also a camp of researchers who believe that by aggregating, you might be preventing something that's even worse. And again, that's speculation at this point, but that's a plausible hypothesis. But you know, in terms of whether things will improve by removing these aggregates, and by aggregates again, I'm referring to Lewy bodies. That's something that we just need to try and find out. I can't think of many examples where this has been done successfully. Mm-hmm. But once we have those tools, I think we'll begin to address that.
So based on what you just said, that those kind of aggregate formations are almost a defense mechanism of the cell, or they might be anyways?
Yeah, so that's been speculated by some researchers. Personally, I think that if I were to bet, I would think that the aggregates are probably more harmful than helpful. But again, it's something that we don't know at this point. There's a lot of studies going into trying to address this problem.
Okay. Now, I had heard that there are also different forms of alpha-synuclein itself, and I was wondering just how different those different forms of alpha-synuclein are, and if you could, do you know, have any idea how many different kinds there are? And also added to that question, have we made any progress in determining which strains lead to which disease phenotypes?
So, let me explain, at least one way to think about this idea of different kinds of alpha-synuclein, or strains, as they call it. So strains typically refer to forms of disease or forms of disease-causing agents that have very characteristic symptoms or characteristic disease properties, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so what we see in diseases associated with alpha-synuclein, whether it's Parkinson's disease or dementia with Lewy bodies, or multiple system atrophy, which also has alpha-synuclein aggregates. These diseases all have alpha-synuclein aggregates, but they're also very different from a clinical perspective. And so that's led to the idea that multiple strains might exist of alpha-synuclein. It's the same protein, but maybe misfolding in different ways to cause these different diseases. In terms of how many different strains there are, I think if we take sort of this initial observation that there are at least half a dozen diseases that can be characterized as alpha-synucleinopathies, then you would probably suppose that there are at least half a different strains. And I think there's a lot of emerging data from multiple labs now, and especially from Virginia Lee's lab, here at Penn, that suggests that clinically, in human patients, there are multiple strains that exist. Now, and Stan Kuzner's lab has also shown data to suggest that as well. Now, in vitro, in a test tube, several groups, such as Ronald Melki's group in France, have actually been able to generate at least half a dozen, and I think probably far beyond that number now, of alpha-synuclein strains. So the possibility, the whole universe of alpha-synuclein strains, if I had to guess, would probably be in the hundreds, if not more. Now, it's much harder to say how many of those are actually relevant to diseases that exist in our world, and or maybe they fall into distinct categories. And that's, again, another very intense area of research right now. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I know another kind of, I don't want to call it a heated debate, but I know there's another cause of a lot of discussion in Parkinson's, is this idea about whether or not Parkinson's is a prion disease. And I was just kind of wondering where you fall in this debate, and also, why does it really matter if we classify it as a prion disease or not?
So I think, to be very precise, the original term, prion was to define proteins that are infectious entities. And think the traditional definition of infectious is from organism to organism.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we were to use that strict definition, then I think that alpha-synuclein and also Parkinson's as an extension of that is not a prion disease per se. Now, alpha-synuclein in many ways behaves like a prion protein or like the prion protein from which we derive the term prion. And for example, it's able to self-amplify, it can spread and transfer from one part of the body to another. It exists as multiple strains and it causes disease. But I think the big missing element there is this idea of organism-to-organism infectivity. Mm. And why that's important, I think it's there's two reasons for that, two main reasons. The first of all is that it affects and influences the way we go about treating and thinking about the disease. So if it's something that's infectious and communicable, I think our strategies for treating needs to include a sort of preventative, if almost barrier-like kind of approach. And I don't think there's any evidence for that, and I don't think we should advocate that with our words. And which leads to my second point, which is that if we call it a prion disease, for the audiences who are not quite as well versed in what original prion definition is, they might have the mistaken impression that these are diseases that are communicable.
Mm.
And I think that, first of all, sends an inaccurate message. But secondly, it raises unnecessary alarm and distress to patients and also the people around them who are, already dealing with very challenging circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably not going to be very helpful for them.
Fair enough. Now, another idea that I came across that kind of, when I first heard about it, it kind of blew me away, to be honest, is this idea of proteostasis or proteostasis. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. And I came across a couple of researchers who believe that one day we'll be able to, and possibly one day soon, we'll be able to account for and even maybe control the mechanisms that regulate proteostasis. I was wondering how much faith kind of I should put in those ideas that we will be able to control this process. And if so, what would that actually mean for medical science? Because it seems like it would mean a great deal, but I guess I just wanted to get your take on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think proteostasis, this idea of maintaining proteins in a sort of optimal integrity, if you will, optimal function,
mm-hmm.
That's a very important thing. I think it's necessary for health. It's necessary for life. Necessary for proper functioning. And so, ways that help promote proteostasis. So proteostasis is something that tends to diminish or fail with age. It's not entirely clear why that's the case, but there's a lot of really good research being done into that. To be able to sort of maintain or augment proteostasis, especially later on in life, I think that'll reap a lot of benefits. We do need to be careful to not over-regulate proteins that are, not meant to be, meddled with later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
I think, for example, cancer and oncology hold a lot of examples where cancer cells actually sort of hijack proteostasis, if you will, to their own for their own ends.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be very cautious of that. But at any time you can maintain your proteins in tip-top shape, that bodes well for the organism.
Do you see this as a likelihood in the near future?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of work being done on that from a lot of different fields. People who are interested in neurodegeneration, obviously, but also people who are working, as I mentioned, in oncology, also in aging, and even basic biology matters. You know, the body, the mammalian body, even unicellular organisms, they all go through a lot of processes which are very stressful in one way or another. And it's quite amazing to see how cells and organisms deal with that. And so they have these very powerful proteostasis mechanisms. And so as we learn more about them, I think it'll be possible to harness some of this knowledge and turn them maybe into sort of therapeutic or preventative strategies for people.
Okay. Now, the last question I wanted to ask kind of came from, I think, the philosopher in me. Is life itself a protein folding problem?
Yeah, I think in many ways it is. Maybe I wouldn't use the word problem because life itself is a pretty pleasant thing. I would liken it more like, I think it was Sue Lindquist, very, very well-known biologist, who likened life to a dance of proteins. They need to be in good shape, they need to be well coordinated, and if everybody is doing what they're supposed to, then it's a very beautifully choreographed sequence of events that takes place, and it's something just very beautiful to behold. But when something goes wrong with one of these things, or if things are out of whack or out of balance, then it becomes a proverbial train wreck, if you will. So I think definitely being able to balance and sustain proteins is a big challenge in maintaining health and keeping, sustaining life.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Professor Luke. That was great. And I think anybody who listens to that will definitely get a lot out of that conversation. There was definitely a lot of interesting things to unpack there, and I look forward to going back and reading it again and listening to it a couple times to really understand and grasp everything. But thank you for everything that you do, and thank you for all that you do for the Parkinson's community as well.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And I know, just because there's a more general audience, there's some questions where I didn't go too deep into the details. So if you later on want to have very specific examples,